Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 22nd, 2005. This session, The Human Genome Project, Promises and Pitfalls, presented by Grant Thorsett in the Fireside Room, disc number THG-2005-05. Let's listen in.
Those genes, what are the letters? Remember that there are four different sort of letters of the genetic code, the four different components of DNA. We call them A, G, C, and T, adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. Those are the chemical names of those components that make up the DNA. And an effort began then to decipher, to determine that sequence. So it's like going through an Encyclopedia Britannica and determining the sequence of every letter and the words that make up that. Talk a little bit about what the goals were other than just the determination of that little history, and then techniques we've already talked about that become important because of our knowledge of the code. Robert Sinsheimer is a molecular biologist, a well-known molecular biologist, and in the 1980s he was the chancellor of University of California at Santa Cruz. So he moved into administration, out of research, chancellor's position, which in places like mine would be called the president of the university, not the chancellor, but the California system calls them chancellors. And in 1985, he made a proposal to the scientific community that was, we should start an effort to sequence the genome, the human genome, that there would be some great benefits for this. And in 1989, a group of scientists, biological and molecular biologists, computer experts, engineers, industrial scientists, gathered in Bethesda, Maryland at the National Institutes of Health. And the meeting was run by an individual named Norton Zinder, who also was a well-known, really bacterial geneticist. He had made some, there are three ways that bacteria exchange information between them. And he had discovered one of those three in the mid-1950s. And he basically closed the meeting with this statement that today we are initiating an unending study of human biology. Whatever else happens, it will be an adventure, a priceless endeavor. And that was the formal beginning of an effort to start deciphering the sequence of nucleotides, of letters of the genetic code. People have, at the time, were comparing it to the project to produce the first atomic weapons, the Manhattan Project, something of the same magnitude, and also the same magnitude of putting a man on the moon in the Apollo project. So it's a project that was considered to be sort of equivalent to those in its hopes, what was involved in order to come through and actually get that information. So we knew roughly how big the human genome was. And when I say human genome, if it's not clear, and interrupt me, of course, when it's not, things aren't clear, I mean the entire genetic information of one of our cells, and all of our cells have some genetic information. We knew about how big it was, that there were about 3 billion of these little subunits making up the DNA. I mentioned in the very first session, if you were here, that the DNA in an E. coli bacterium, which was where things really started in relative to molecular techniques in genetics, was actually a molecule. It was about 1.1 millimeters in length if you stretched it out. The human genome, if you were to look at its length, now, each of our chromosomes, we have 46 chromosomes, and each of our chromosomes has one DNA molecule. So there are 46 different DNA molecules to decipher. If we were to take those 46 molecules and stretch them out, measure their length, it's about right there. It's a little over a meter in length. And that's packed into every one of our cells. So you can think of the packing problem. I mean, it's a very, very small diameter molecule, but you can think of the packing problem. If you have something that's this big and it's got to all be packed, condensed, organized, so that we'll fit in each and every one of our cells. Every cell has that much DNA. That's what's being deciphered. The goals of the project, or the basic goal, are the first two, to identify the genes. At this point, people didn't know how many genes. The estimate was about 100,000 genes to make a human when this project started. To identify those genes, determine where they are on the chromosomes. And we have 23 different kinds of chromosomes, because we have pairs of chromosomes, half inherited from mom and half from dad, maternal and paternal chromosomes. And they vary in length. The first goal was to determine where are the various genes. Where is the gene for hemoglobin? Where is the gene for the transmitting protein that is involved when it's faulty that produces cystic fibrosis, etc. So where are they? And then to determine this sequence of letters that make up the genes. Those are the major goals of the project. But in addition to that, there were some what we might call minor goals. One was to produce public databases of the information that was obtained. So as genes were, or parts of chromosomes were sequenced, and we learned the sequence, those were to go into public databases so that anybody could get access to them. Now, there was a period of time when there was a lot of debate going on because biotechnology companies were trying to patent these things and say, okay, we have discovered the sequence of gene X, and now we are going to get a patent on that, and if you want to use that information, you're going to have to pay us. Okay? And that went back and forth, and that really flies against the whole concept of free flow of information in science. So you had the pure research scientists very, very much against that concept. And yet the biotechnology industry saying, well, we can't make any money, if we go to all this work to learn this information. And this is an effort that's being carried out by probably hundreds of labs, a cooperative effort. And what's the incentive for us to do all of this work if we just have to turn it over and have public access to it? So that debate went on, and it went in and out of courts. But now information is put into public databases. Interesting enough, that major federal database is just called Gene Bank, as you might guess. In order to improve the technology for the analysis of the data, this involves tremendous amount of computer time and technology. And so one of the goals was to improve that, and not only just for the analysis, but also collecting the data. A lot of technology was developed in order to support this project. And much of it, by the way, since we are in the state of Washington, one of the prime movers and actually the technology involved in deciphering the genetic code is over at the University of Washington. An individual by the name of Leroy Hood spent his entire career, his area of interest is the technical aspects, the instrumentation, things of that sort, analysis of algorithms for the computer people. And he spent the beginnings of his career, the majority of his career actually, has been spent at California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, where he developed things like the instrument that could automatically determine the sequence of amino acids in a protein, and the instrument that could automatically, the first one that could automatically determine sequences of DNA, et cetera. And then several years ago now, Bill Gates came through and gave the University of Washington $25 million to establish a biotechnology center. And he brought Leroy Hood up from California Institute of Technology to head up that center. It's a consortium of departments. It's got computer science people, it's got engineers, it's got biologists, it's got a variety of people in this institute that Leroy Hood directs. He has the title of the William Gates III Professor of Biotechnology at the University of Washington, and really a critical individual in the development of the technology. The first time I heard Leroy Hood speak, it was at Reed College, and it was right shortly after Bill Gates got married, and the person that was introducing Hood said, and before anybody asks, yes, he did attend Bill Gates' wedding. You know, that was the big thing. But anyway, he was fortunately, we were able to get him for the dedication of our new biology and chemistry building in 96 as a speaker on campus. A very interesting fellow.
I have a question. When they set out to do this in 1989, did they have an idea of the amount of, were they looking forward to how many years? Were they fast-tracking
yes.
it? Were they?
Yeah, and I'll make a comment on that, okay. on a little history, but yes, there that was done. I'm going to come back to the okay. history in a second thing. And one of the aspects was the last one, that there had to be some effort to address legal, ethical questions that were related. And in fact, ultimately what happened is that 3% of the money that went into this project was earmarked and dedicated for education, for study of ethical and legal issues. So that there was a very serious endeavor at that point. Come on. Whoop. And Mary Pat knows exactly what to do. Thank you. So continue on a little bit on the history. So 89 was really when the scientific, a group of scientists and engineers, et cetera, said, yes, this is important, we will support it, we will do what we can, start raising money for it, developing the technology, et cetera, et cetera. In 1990, James Watson and Crick, the person that discovered the structure of DNA along with his colleague Francis Crick. James Watson was named the director of this program. And at that time, they proposed a budget of $3 billion. I've actually seen the number $5 billion somewhere, but I think the $3 billion is correct. I hope it is. It's either three or five. I've read both. But in any case, it's a lot of money. And a timeline of 15 years to complete the project. The funding came through from the National the Department of Energy was initially the one that was involved with this project, but ultimately the National Institutes of Health and some other federal funding agencies came through with a pledge to support the project at this level. It was a very controversial decision in some aspects because of the amount of money and the people like the medical researchers, the medical community in particular opposed it because they saw this as a drain from traditional research funding to support the research into disease cures, et cetera, by traditional methods. And so there was a lot of debate here, but NIH did end up funding it. James Watson directed the program for about 3 years. At which time he stepped aside, and I don't know what the politics were there, but James Watson's a hard guy to get along with. There's no question about that. He's a brilliant, brilliant man, and he knows how to ask the right scientific questions that can be addressed in the laboratory. Yeah, he's one of the greatest thinkers probably in molecular biology. He's the only one of the four that we talked about earlier involved in the discovery of DNA who's still alive. Both Francis Crick and Maurice Wilkins have died within about the last 8 months. But individual by the name of Francis Collins took over. Francis Collins, one of the biggest names at that point in cystic fibrosis research. And he became the director of the project. Now, there were a lot of things involved here other than just sequencing the human genome. Because you start with something simple. I mean, you always do this. I mean, if you can find simpler models to begin with and develop the technology using simpler organisms, and then you can expand and start utilizing that technology on more complex systems. So this just puts a couple of dates on there. 1995, so 5 years afterwards, the genetic sequence of Haemophilus influenzae. Haemophilus influenzae is a bacterium. It's a relatively small genome for bacteria. It's not the smallest, but relatively small genome. Haemophilus influenzae, as its name suggests, is a causative agent of influenzae-type symptoms, respiratory sorts of conditions. And this is the most common bacterium that causes ear infections in infants. And it can cause, if it gets across the blood-brain barrier, it can cause bacterial meningitis. And this organism turned out to have about 1.8 million, 10 to the 6 is million, about 1.8 million base pairs. Now that's a factor of 1,000 smaller than the human genome. It was estimated about 3 billion times 10 to the 9th, not 10 to the 6th, and was shown to have 1,743 genes. So that was the first free living, non-parasitic, because viruses had been sequenced prior to this, but the first cellular entity to have its sequence known. The next year, Saccharomyces cerevisiae is baker's yeast. It's common old yeast. And what's important about that organism is that it's considered to be the simplest of what we call eukaryotic cells. There are basically two kinds of cells in the world based on the organization of the genetic material. Bacteria, which are called prokaryotic, and other organisms, which are including us, they're called eukaryotic. Eukaryotic organisms all have a regular membrane-bound nucleus, and they have chromosomes like we do. Bacteria don't have chromosomes like we do. But it's considered the simplest of the more advanced cellular type of organism, the yeasts in general. In this particular one, is a lot of work has been done on because it's used in the baking industry, it's used in the brewing industry, and it's just an easy organism to cultivate in the laboratory, etc. So it's a little bit bigger, 12 million base pairs and about 6,000 genes. And then many different organisms have been sequenced during this human genome project, the research and funded by it, the human genome project funding. But then in the February 2001 was a draft sequence of the human genome was published. I should mention maybe that partway through this process, this is a NIH, National Institutes of Health funded project, and carried out by multiple labs, research labs around the country, mostly academic labs, some private labs, but mostly academic labs, medical research labs, things, places of that sort. And late in the game, an individual by the name of Craig Vetner, and I always want to say Venter because it seems like it's easier to say, but no, V-E-T-N-E-R, Vetner, left NIH and developed a biotechnology company called Celera. And he stated, I can solve the problem faster, cheaper, without federal funding. And took off doing it with a completely different approach. The two approaches were that the federal government funded project and Vetner's project. Now his was very, very dependent on technology that had been developed, and very dependent on supercomputers for analysis. And he started out just doing the important genes, the genes that are expressed. Turns out only somewhere between 5 and 10% of the genome produces protein products, and proteins are necessary to express traits. And somewhere between 90 and 95% of the genome, of our genomes, do not code for proteins. And we often call it junk DNA or gibberish DNA. We don't really know why it's all there. We know why some of it's there, but not all of it. By far, I mean the majority of it, we don't have any idea why it's there. And there's this little, it's kind of funny, our genetic message is kind of strange. And we have a series of letters that expresses a trait indirectly that has to produce a protein product. It's actually information to make a protein product. And in the middle of it, it's gibberish. It's like you were reading a book, and then suddenly in the middle of a paragraph, there's just a bunch of random letters and words, and, you know, combinations of letters. And then someplace else, some more sense takes place, which is continuous with what's up here. And then there's some more garbage, and then some more message that's continuous with what's previous. For some reason, and this is, like I say, we don't really understand the reason, that's the way our genetic information is organized. Sections that we call exons, which stand for expressed regions, and sections interspersed called introns, which are interspersed regions.
Do you also find that, like, in the DNA of, like, rhesus monkeys and...
Yes, and we find that in general in all eukaryotic cells. Yeast have very, very, very little of it. Bacteria have none of it. And it seems to be that the more complex an organism is, the more of it there is. Yeah. So if you were to look at something like a marine sponge, there'd be very little of it. But there would be some. But it's, you know, it's one of those things where we know it's there, but we don't know why it's there and what its function is.
And is there any patterning with more sophisticated?
Yes, the more sophisticated organism, it tends to be the more. Yep. So anyway, 2001 in February, both Solaris Vetner and the federal group actually came together, started talking to each other, coordinating some of their efforts, and they jointly published articles. I shouldn't say jointly, they simultaneously published articles making the statement that we have it, we have at least a draft, it's probably 99%, 99.5% accurate of the human genome. One of those was published in Science Magazine, which is the journal for the Association for the Advancement of Science in the United States, and the other one was published in Nature. Vetner's was Nature. It's a comparable scientific journal in Great Britain. And then at that point, saying, well, there's 3.2 billion base pairs. We think there's about 32,000 genes. Now, I said initially they thought there were about 100,000 genes. Partway through, that got down to about 60,000. Oh, no, we think there's only about 60,000 genes. And then at the end, they said, we think there are 32,000 genes. And then in October 2004, the feeling was, as the analysis was going on, the genome project's finished, but now people are analyzing the sequences. And because there are certain kinds of start sequences and stop sequences that are known, like capital letters to start a sentence and a period at the end of a sentence, there's a message. You could, by analyzing these 3 billion base pairs, find all the regions that had the right signals with a reasonable amount of DNA between them, so it would have enough DNA to have the information to make a protein. And we now think that number's down to about 25,000 genes. So it's about, at this point, that's what we think making human genes. So that's a little history of what some of the important milestones along the way.
So they're going to make their 15-year goal.
Oh, thank you. Peter, you said something earlier that I was supposed to say. The feeling was that once this draft came out, and then a little bit of changes within the next year, is that the announcement was made, we are done. And so one of those very, very rare government projects that came in ahead of schedule. Instead of, the goal was not by 2005, and by 2003 it was declared complete, and it came in under budget. So, very rare situation.
So it's done now, as far as that particular 15-year project is concerned.
Yes, okay. It is done. Now, there's not to say that it's not going to be some little modifications.
Sure.
There's people going in and analyze and say, oh no, this genetic region.
Right.
You know, this isn't a C in this position, it's really a G or something. But yes, it's declared, it is complete.
And if you need access to those databases, you can get in because it's public in that sense?
Yes, and so what you can do is you can go in and say, if they know that this particular sequence relates to a particular gene, you could go into the database and say, you know, sort of, I want to look at the gene for hemophilia.
Mm-hmm.
For blood clotting factor, I mean, the hemophilia would be the mutant form
right.
of it, and you can then get those sequences, and they're very useful. You've been in other sessions, so when we talked about amplifying a particular section of
mm-hmm.
DNA,
right.
you need to have information
right.
about the ends of that DNA, and to design these things called primers that allow you to put tags on the DNA that say, I want to amplify in between these regions. And so our students go into the databases for primer design, things of that sort, quite often. Now, these are techniques, these are things we've talked about in the past, during the week. And these are some of the techniques and advances that really have been enhanced because of the Human Genome Project, because technology has changed. And we might even think about, you know, making a comparison with some other major government projects, like putting a man on the moon. You know, people have said, well, at the time, why would you spend all this money just to put a person on the moon? Well, probably for political reasons, because Usher was doing it, or planning to do things like that. They were taking over space because they launched Sputnik before we had any satellites to run around the Earth. But in any case, I mean, a lot of it might have been political, but what were some of the spin-offs? Miniaturization of electronics had to be developed to get into those spacecrafts.
All kinds
computers
of materials
to develop, integrated circuits so they could develop the kinds of, you know, there have been a lot of spin-offs that we might not think about. The development of a lot of that technology wouldn't have happened unless there was a goal to get a spaceship that would, a capsule of some sort that would be able to house all of the electronics. You know, we probably wouldn't have, you know, eventually we would have, but we wouldn't have had electronic calculators. I don't know, I remember when I was an undergraduate, there were no electronic calculators that could divide. You know, we had mechanical Monroe calculators that you turned the old crank and it went chunk, 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 and subtracted by the sequential subtraction and counted how many times it subtracted till it got less than zero and bounced back a unit and chunk, 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 chunk. You know? And I remember when I was at Willamette, early, probably maybe the first or second year I was there, came out with an electronic calculator that was to buy. And not only that, it would take the square root.
It was TI, probably.
That's right, it was a TI. Texas Instruments came out with one. And it's, this thing was this big and this thick and that wide. And that's all it did. You know, it added, subtracted, multiplied, divided, square root. $1,960. That thing was $125, $150. You know? And now things much more common, you know, are giveaways.
Yeah.
They're in Cracker Jacks, probably. And that wouldn't have happened so rapidly, at least, without the space program. So much the same has happened here. In trying to get through this, the technology to do the analysis, the actual instrumentation evolved in order to do this, and now we are reaping the benefits of the technology. These are just a list of some of the things that have been improved or even developed because of the technology and the work on the human genome projects, things we've talked about, human genetic testing techniques. Last night, if you were at the forum, Dorothy Bass was talking about the fact that when she was pregnant, when she was encouraged to undergo amniocentesis for genetic testing 20 years ago, she didn't do it. But all that they would have learned probably 20 years ago is, does this fetus embryo have an extra chromosome or not? Mm-hmm. It was Down syndrome screening. Mm-hmm. You know, not much else. And now we talked in the last few days. We talked about techniques where an individual cell from a developing embryo at the 6, 8, something like that cell stage, can be analyzed for a variety of genetic abnormalities. You know, things of that sort. Forensics lab DNA fingerprinting techniques. The gene therapy that we talked about yesterday, the use of genes for pharmaceutical purposes, modified crops, all of these, and you know, they would have happened, but they've been accelerated in applications because of the technology that's spin off from the genome project. I think we skipped a slide way back when, but I think we did. We can go back. There was one slide that we skipped, and it's all out of, see, I think one more. Here we go. Was the Y slide. This should have been way up there, and I double skipped it. I didn't notice it. Why was this important to do? Where has it had some major impacts? And just listed enough that would fit on the screen. That in medicine, the improvement of diagnosis, as we just spoke now, but also the treatment. By knowing the sequence, if there's a gene that, let's say, is overexpressed, and this can happen where you get too much product because control systems aren't working right. There are controlling genes and there are genes that produce proteins. There are genes that produce products that control genes that produce proteins. If you have a gene that's, say, overexpressed, or perhaps it's an abnormal gene that produces an abnormal product, and you want to turn it off, if you know the sequence there now within the last few years, knowing the sequence, you can design designer drugs that target that sequence specifically. and inhibit it. The production of, quote, designer drugs. And one way to do that, one approach, is to design sequences that are complementary to the NA, so they stick to and to the gene of the target gene and prevent its expression, because it's something stuck there and prevents the process of RNA production, which is necessary before you have protein production. So sequencing, so medicine improved treatment, and with not just these sort of complementary sequence approaches, but also certain kinds of drugs. And certain antibiotics do bind onto nucleic acids, onto DNA. And by designing those drugs so that they fit particular sequences, you can target them at a particular target. I have a colleague who, in her PhD work, in her postdoc work, down at University of California in San Diego, very involved in the in modifying drugs so that they would sit on certain sequences, and she's still carrying that out at Willamette to some extent, working with students to do that.
So does could these diseases eventually possibly be able to be the injection of those, or to eliminate those sequences? Or because I'm thinking the ethical part of it, that the pharmaceutical has been able to create the designer drugs, are they inhibiting some of that advancement?
No, I don't think so, because I think there's enough interest in the correction, and that's the gene replacement therapy. I think there's enough interest in the medical community to pursue the research into gene replacement therapy, where a new gene can be actually inserted to correct, so that you have, so these are in trials now, but they have been successful with one of the immune deficiency syndromes, where individual couldn't make right kind of antibodies because of a single gene that was missing, and that has been substituted in. She's doing fine 18 years later. She was the first trial, but certain genes, and there's a lot of work going on now in clinical trials to combat some of hemophilia, Leber's disease, cystic fibrosis, there's work in Alzheimer's, there's work in Parkinson's, and some others that are.
I want to make sure I understand what.
There's not a clash. I mean, there's not a
the
clash.
Pharmaceutical versus the. Is there a clash?
I honestly don't know. I would expect there might be, but I don't think that.
Thinking of scientific versus the capitalism.
Right. I'm sure there is that clash. I'm not, familiar with details of it, but. But you would just automatically expect there is, and I'm not sure there is. I mean, there's a lot of politics going on in all of these, and driven by economic interests, but also there are ethical considerations. Certain religions, certain denominations have stands one way or the other, and that affects it.
There also are probably trade-offs too. Maybe the pharmaceutical option is a better option because you learn that long-term the other technique doesn't work. I mean, there can be multiple solutions sometimes.
I'm convinced that life is nothing but a series of trade-offs.
Me too. Me too.
Well, developmental biologists are the people that worry about, think about what are the mechanisms to go from that fertilized egg to an adult. Understanding that, developmental biology, certain embryos don't develop properly for one reason or the other. And why not? I mean, it could be an environmental thing, whatever. But by knowing, but much has been done because of the understanding of specific genes that control normal development processes and how that might be go astray sometimes and result in birth deformities, things of that sort. It's interesting if you actually look at some of the data that over 60% of miscarriages have chromosomal abnormalities. Miscarriages are really a very beneficial thing because they sort out many genetic problems. And if we look at quite often fertilized eggs are produced that have abnormal numbers of chromosomes. And it could be any of the 23 different kinds of chromosomes, 20 or 23 pairs in our cells. And if you look at chromosomal abnormalities at birth, Down syndrome has an extra chromosome 21, which is one of the very small chromosomes. There's something called Edwards syndrome, something called Patau syndrome. One is an extra number 18, if I remember right, one's an extra 15. Those individuals have a life expectancy of less than 1 year. Down's is the only one where there's a long life expectancy. And other, what we call trisomic conditions, meaning you have three of one of the kinds of chromosomes instead of two, just don't exist. They're in aborted fetuses, but they don't exist as live births. You know, so miscarriages are really sort of, we really make a lot of mistakes in making gametes, produce egg or sperm cells and have too many abnormal chromosomes or abnormal chromosome numbers. Majority of those things are miscarriages. Evolutionary biologists utilize a lot of sequence information now to understand relationships within and between populations. I have a colleague who works on an endangered plant species down in Oregon. That population, those of you who are familiar with the Oregon coast, that exists at Cascade Head, which is just north of Lincoln City. And there are similar, listed as an endangered plant. And at one time, it's thought that was the only population. There's a similar plant that grows in the Kamiopsis wilderness area in southwestern Oregon, and she is working on whether these are actually the same species or not, and using molecular technology to do that, looking at comparisons between populations. And when biologists say, use the term population, they mean a group of the same species in an area. And so there's these two populations. And they can also utilize some of this technology now to look at changes over time. And then a couple of other points here that are important. Comparative biology, to understand differences between individuals. We think that probably the difference between you and me is 0.1% of our genome at the most. Okay, 0.1%. Yeah, you have a question, Ben?
No.
Okay. And trying to understand, you know, how that can make the difference that it does. Some people will ask, well, we're all different, so how can we have a human genome sequence? Whose sequence do we have? Well, number one, the sequence is probably male, and that's not for sexist reasons. It's because males have a Y chromosome and females don't. And so females have two X chromosomes, males have an X and a Y. And so we would be missing one kind of chromosome if we were looking as our individuals whose DNA has been sequenced, and the moment we're females, we would be missing the Y chromosome component. As this was set up, it was set up that it would be multiple individuals, anonymous individuals. They got the cells mostly from tissue culture cells. You can grow in the laboratory cells from animals, including humans, and they're maintained for various reasons, and that's probably the source of most of them. We don't know who they are. I mean, it's not public information. It hasn't been announced, but the idea was that there's probably 10 or more different males that have had their sequence, and then we do what's called a consensus sequence. And so you might find as you go through this sequence that 9 of these individuals at this particular point all have a C, and that 10th one has a G. Well, the C would be reported. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of a composite average sequence. excuse me. It's come out fairly recently that the Solera project, that was the one that was competing with the federal project at the end. But the Solera project and the founder of Solera was Craig Bettner, and that it's come out since that all of the samples were probably him.
He was
motivated to find out his own. That's the rumor right now. So, last slide, when we get to it. Some of the questions that have come up concerning this information, knowing the sequence. Probably the biggest one is the genetic privacy issue. That when the technology now becomes available, so I can go in to my physician and say, I want to know my DNA sequence, or at least for maybe just for particular genes. I'm suffering from whatever it is, and I want to have my sequence. Eventually that'll happen, where people can get their own sequences, whether it's full sequences or at least partial sequences. Well, what happens with that information? It goes into databanks, or if it's accessible, like in someone's medical records, but what if those records are accessible? Or, what now my insurance company can find out. And they can find out a lot of things already, right? They can find out my credit history to see how much premium they're going to charge me. Now they know, I have a gene that increases my probability of developing prostate cancer by 50%. Okay? Doesn't say I'm going to get it, but I'm more likely to. And there's a lot of information, by the way, on breast cancer genes. They're some of the first ones that have been studied.
So actuaries are going to have a whole new thing to work with, aren't they?
They could have if they had this information.
Right.
And does that mean, okay, I'm not going to be insurable? Or my premiums are going to be 50% higher? I always understood that the philosophy of insurance was that you spread the risk to many people, and you might come down with this condition and benefit from the risk pool, but you may never benefit, and you paid all these premiums in, but you're just part of of the risk pool. But now, can we start saying, I am going to insure you, but at 50% more premium, or I'm not going to insure you because you have a 50% increased risk of developing breast cancer. Or we'll write that as an exclusion. We'll cover you medically, but not for conditions X, Y, and Z. I remember when my youngest son and his partner set up a business in Flagstaff, Arizona, and they tried to get a group health policy for their business, and they had nothing but trouble because his partner was a skydiver,
right,
hang glider, and a few other things. And they had problems getting insurance because of the risks that rock climber. And not only that, but a rock climber with only one hand, because he was a thalidomide kid and was born with only one hand. And he still did all these things. Asked one of our sons who used to climb with him, said, how does Al do that? He said, he just jams his stud in a crack and pulls himself up. But the insurance, they really had concerns, problems getting insurance for a group policy to cover them and their employees. Same thing with employment. If you know that here's an individual that if they're exposed to a particular industrial product that's being involved in a manufacturing process, and that could induce something could induce a cancer because they have a higher probability of developing this cancer, are you going to employ them? That's going to do something to your insurance. Are you going to employ a person that because of their genetic makeup, may be only with you for 5 years, and you've spent all the money in training this individual? So there's some real concerns here, and this is where, as was stated last night at the forum, is that the science gets done, the technology precedes the ethical discussions and the policy discussions. And then there's ethical issues that have been discussed, at least brought up, maybe not discussed necessarily, but brought up earlier this week on just transgenic organisms in general. Is this a moral or ethical thing to do to modify our food crops, etc., or gene replacement therapy? I'm too short. I want to be an NBA player. I want an extra shot at growth hormone gene, please.
Getting back to the genetic privacy, I think this also raises the question, how much information do people want to know?
That's right.
You were told that you were going to get Alzheimer's disease at 70, would you want to know that? And then also how much information people will be entitled to.
Right.
And who decides?
And who decides?
That was a big
who decides? Yeah. I had brought with me a video. We didn't have any real good time that we could put it together. I was going to use a little bit of a clip on it, on gene replacement therapy yesterday. It just wasn't going to work for me. I brought a video called Children by Design. And it discusses various things, aspects. It really goes into the first gene replacement therapy that was done in the politics and the policy that had to be followed and all of this. It took 3.5 years to get that trial approved by the Food and Drug Administration. But also there's one particular clip in there with an individual who has early Alzheimer's onset, and there is a gene it's an inherited trait. Early Alzheimer's sets in the 30s typically, okay? And there's a very good relationship between a particular genetic makeup and that particular condition. And his sister is, in this clip, his sister is a kindergarten teacher in her 30s, and the question was posed to her, but aren't you going to get tested for this? And she said, absolutely not. I don't want to know. Because there is no treatment. Right. If there is no treatment, I don't want to know that I'm likely in the next 5 or 6 years to come down with this condition. She had made the decision not to be genetically tested, even though it had been very easy to do, easily done. And that's the point you were bringing up. Do you really want to know? Do you really want to know that you have 3 times the normal chance to develop breast cancer? Maybe you do, because there might be things you could do to monitor and resolve the issue. Michael, you have a comment?
Yeah, just another issue where the whole genetic privacy comes in, speaking from a Canadian perspective. The insurance issue isn't such a big deal, because if you have universal health care, that kind of helps that. Mm-hmm. However, one of the things in Canada, and I'm sure elsewhere, once the technology becomes more advanced, genetics can be used in terms of screening with regard to immigration. Just like now, for example, if you want to immigrate to Canada or elsewhere, you have your x-rays and you're tested for HIV and so on, and determining whether or not you can come into the country. It could come to the thing that one would want, a country might ask for this kind of genetic screening because they sure. don't want, as potential citizens or even landed immigrants, we call them, or aliens, green card folks here, people with those kinds of diseases that become problematic.
Right. So an economical burden on the healthcare
right.
system.
Right. So that not only we sometimes talk about eugenics and creating the ideal person, there's also, at least in terms of immigration policy, a kind of demographic policy where you try to create an ideal population that mm-hmm. does not have these kinds of genetic defects or whatever you want to call it.
That's
yeah.
a really good
point. Very good point. Yes.
I have a question. You mentioned things like science and nature as journals.
Yes.
What about for the more common reader? Any particular, things that you think to stay current in the information?
Yeah, I think I could name a couple. Actually, science and nature are very generalist kind. They deal with all areas of science.
Right.
And they have staff writers that write articles that are not research articles. Articles that talk about to more of the lay, because they're sending, they have physicists that are subscribing to
right.
science, and then there are articles that deal with issues like this, and so they have articles in that are more towards the layman,
though
they're towards scientific layman, if you will. And Nature has a series in all their issues called News and Views, where somebody will. My son used to write News and Views articles for Nature and Astronomy. Those become a little more. But to get really at your issue, I think Discover Magazine does a pretty good job.
Okay.
You've got Scientific American.
Yeah.
Trying to think. and then there are one. I would think those probably would be the those come to mind first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
But Discover usually does a pretty good job.
Public oversight. The NIH seems to have such great power.
Sure.
In direction of research.
They do.
And the president, of course, had executive orders regarding stem cell. But is it to your congressional representatives? It's the best way to communicate regarding NIH priorities, or
if they listen to it. It doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
It doesn't hurt. And you could talk to Gordon Smith. You're an Oregonian. I have a couple of things here. If you're interested, I think Graham never mentioned, but if anybody's interested in sort of the history of some of the biotechnology, here's a little handout on milestones in the history of technology from the early 70s to the late 90s. It's not updated, but it shows some of the key things that have happened and the rapidity in which they've happened. And here's a list. It's not a very good list. I started putting it together as I was trying to prepare some of my information for these this series of talks, but a little bit of a bibliography. And this bibliography, a couple of these books are ones that are very much anti-biotechnology. So I tried to balance it a little bit on this bibliography. It's very, very minimal. It was the sources I tended to use. And you're sure welcome to those. And I really, again, let me just say thank you for your attention.
Thank you.
It's been a fun week. I've really enjoyed it, and I hope you have too. And
thank you.
Maybe I'll come next year. Who knows? If anybody wants to get a hold of me in the future, I'm at Willamette University, gthorsett@willamette.edu, or look up the Willamette University homepage, and you'll find a link.